It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. While protests following the death of George Floyd have taken place in America's biggest cities, they're happening in smaller communities as well and at levels not seen in decades. Coming up, we'll take a look at what's going on in smaller cities around Wisconsin. First, scrapbooking these days has a reputation as a hobby for extreme crafters, maybe, or something that requires just the right paper, album, tools, stickers, templates. It's more than that, though, and it has a long history. Our next guest once had a collection of over 200 older scrapbooks dating from the beginning of the 19th century to the present and containing all kinds of things, remnants of hair, obituary clips, fabric swatches, remnants of everyday life. Jessica Helfand is an artist, designer, and writer. She's a founding editor of Design Observer and the author of several books, including Scrapbooks and American History, and her latest, Face, A Visual Odyssey. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, you had built up this big collection of scrapbooks. What opened the door, or I guess the cover, of the scrapbook world for you?
Well, I come from a family of collectors, so you couldn't come to the dinner table without talking about a collection. So it's part of my DNA to look to amass something that I can make sense of. And these things are actually quite compelling because they're so sort of raw and emotional and personal, and yet they start to speak to each other if you look at them as a cultural historian, which I'm a visual historian. I'm interested in the social history of why people make things. And it became very interesting to me that unlike scrapbooks today, which follow certain canonical conventional formats, 100 years ago, they were not formatted at all. They were not gendered. They were not beacons of meaning about anything more than whatever the maker wanted them to be. And in that way, they were, as I say in the book, sort of, you know, outsider art with insider knowledge.
What kind of things did some of the earliest scrapbook creators that you discovered, what kind of things did they collect?
Well, they were interested in sort of rescuing things. And there's a beautiful kind of carpe diem, seizing the day notion of rescuing the things in your midst and cementing them to the page. And it's interesting we're talking about scrapbooks during a moment of incredible social unrest, because one of the things I found in my research is that people started to keep scrapbooks long ago in the days of certainly Thomas Jefferson was a big scrapbook keeper. Mark Twain was a big scrapbook keeper. But there was always a surge in the keeping of journals and the visual rescue, the physical rescue of evidence during times of political and social unrest and upheaval, really going back to the Civil War. The ones that I collected were primarily between about 1850 and 1940. They started to get less interesting to me once television entered the living room, and there were other sources of visual stimuli and experience. But I found all sorts of things. I mean, people would save candle grease from a candle that had burned down over dinner. There were cigarette stubs. There were lots of wrappers, of candy wrappers and gum wrappers, cigarette wrappers and matchbooks. And of course, I'm trained as a graphic designer, so the typography and the wording and what something cost that you could buy a Hershey bar for 5 cents, all of this was really interesting to me because you could, almost like a forensic analyst, place the person in the place, in the moment, historically, culturally, when they would have found value in that thing. And really what it comes down to, the bigger answer to, I think, your very good question, is that it was really about what people, how people found, located, isolated, identified value and decided what was worth keeping.
I've talked to people about the idea of a curiosity cabinet, where people would actually have cabinets and collect weird stuff. And I think it was kind of a wealthier sort of thing. You can find these oddities. This almost sounds like the home version of that, a very inexpensive way to build your own curiosity collection like that. Is that part of what people were doing?
Also, a cabinet by its very nature is a display case on view for everybody. There's something much more private about a book. You can close the cover, you can put it on a bookshelf, you can lock it away. And many people have asked me if I felt that I was prying when I found these scrapbooks, many of which turned up at garage sales and on eBay. And usually they turn up because the children and the grandchildren don't want them. But what you see when you go through these pages is people trying to make sense of the world, the proximity. What would possess someone to put a prayer card next to a picture of Rudy Valentino? What would possess someone to, you know, put a love letter from someone that they didn't want to admit to being in love with upside down so you can't see the name on the front? There were lots of inverted hinges in these books, lots of sort of covert, cryptic kinds of visual language. And I found all of them really meaningful and very sort of poignant, because secrecy has a long history. And again, not like a curiosity cabinet, these things were really hidden from view in many cases, but they were loved and beloved. And one thing I would add also is that during the Depression, when paper was hard to come by, you would see scrapbooks made on the tops of books that no longer held their service. So, for example, an old math book from a school, or a phone book, or a Sears and Roebuck catalog. And so you would get these kind of layered things where you could, if you read between the cracks, you could see their former use, which I found very powerful.
We're talking to Jessica Helfand about the history of scrapbooks. She's written books, including one called Scrapbooks and American History. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you keep scrapbooks now? Have you seen older ones, maybe from a family member, that sound kind of like what Jessica is talking about? You can join in at 800-642-1234. So maybe it was different from person to person in the early days, Jessica, but it sounds like maybe people would have treated this as a diary. Or might I, if I were a scrapbooker circa 1850, might I have shown it to, you know, a close friend or something like that?
It really depended on your age and a little bit on your gender. I mean, schoolgirls are schoolgirls, and older people tended to be a little more conservative. They were religious scrapbooks. They were scrapbooks just of collections, you know, every picture you could find of the Dion quintuplets. There was, for a time in the late 19th century, a tendency to keep scrapbooks not only of obituaries, and I mean only death notices, but the more gruesome, the better. There was a kind of strange schadenfreude that happened where people would save things as if to say, you know, that was them, not me. I'm still standing here. And again, that comes back to this notion of carpe diem. I may not be here tomorrow, but I'm here now. And so the process of gluing something in a book was a way to sort of solidify your own impermanence, your own sense of instability in a world that was spinning out of control. So they really did change. And then you visually, they got really interesting in the early 20th century. And you start seeing people with scissors, and they're cutting out heads, and they're switching the heads. Long before deepfakes, long before robotics, they were experimenting with selfhood, with romance, with sort of different couplings of things. They're writing poetry. They're circling things. They're tearing things out. There's sort of more composite footage and different kinds of forms of collage. And they get really unruly, which the world was, of course, spinning out of control. You've got, you know, two wars in less than 50 years, and the scrapbooks bore witness to all of it.
Looking at more modern times, I know you like the, you know, sort of everybody was winging it style of these older scrapbooks. And now we have, I think it's fair to call it a scrapbook industry, where somebody uncreative like me could get a scrapbook with lots of prompts in it. And so I know I'm doing it the right way. You think we've lost something there, if I read you right?
I do think we've lost something there. I think everybody does it the right way. And that's precisely its beauty. So the sort of, you know, I've referred to it as a kind of meaningless visual grammar. If you need books and prompts and Martha Stewart and all kinds of things to tell you what paper to buy, I mean, it's a booming industry. And it has a beautiful provenance. If you go back to Mormon culture, the Church of Latter-day Saints, and the desire to really keep track of your family tree. So there's many things to recommend why it demands to be, or deserves at least to be, something we still do today. But I think what got lost with this sort of urgency for some kind of convention, and I mean really not only visual conventions, but conventions where people would come together and have clubs and outings and overnights where you would pay scrapbooking societies to kind of do this with other people, got away from me from the notion that it's actually a very individual pursuit. And that's the beauty. It's your life. It's your parents. It's your school. It's what mattered to you. And just like keeping a yearbook and having your friends sign your yearbook are meaningful to you years later, maybe you tell your children. But the degree of how private it is or personal is up to you. The opportunity is really yours. And I think, you know, to come back to why that's interesting to me is that, you know, I'm trained as an artist and a designer, and I've taught for many years and I've collected for many years. And I was really taken by the degree to which people who were not visually trained felt so compelled to keep these remarkably, I think, idiosyncratic books about their own life experience. So the idea that a visual diarist is in each one of us, to me, is a beautiful, compelling notion about the human spirit and the resolve and the sort of tenacity we have to keep things and save things and make those determinations editorially about proximity and time and space and value.
We're talking to Jessica Helfand. She's a founding editor of Design Observer and the author of several books, including Scrapbooks and American History. We're talking about scrapbooking, past and present, how it's changed over the years, the meaning, the design, and more has changed a lot. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history, the early days of scrapbooking? Have you done it yourself? Is it something you do now? Have you picked it up lately with, stay at home in place for a while there? What motivates you to do it? What kind of things do you put into it? Or do you have that, family heirloom or maybe something you found at a garage sale, somebody else's scrapbook from long ago? What did you see in it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post, by the way, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jessica Helfand, a graphic designer and founding editor of Design Observer. She's the author of books including Scrapbooks and American History. We're talking about scrapbooking. The history of the hobby goes back further than I had thought and what scrapbooking looks like now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a scrapbooker yourself? Love to hear your story, the kind of things that you put in it, or if you've seen ones in your family, what did they put in maybe back in the day? Do you have a question about how far back this goes and what people did in the early days? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Deborah on the line in Eau Claire. Deborah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you want to tell us about, Deborah?
A couple of things. I kept a scrapbook when I was in high school in the early to mid-70s and put all kinds of things in there about the Vietnam War. And then when I was in college, I kept it going. But I don't think anybody's ever going to want them, so I don't even know why I did it. And so the other thing was I kept a COVID-19 journal for the Wisconsin State Historical Society and stuck all kinds of things in there, little pieces of fabric from the masks I made for nurses and stuff. And I guess I just don't know who would even ever care about that except me.
Deborah, thank you for calling. Go ahead, Jessica.
I love this. Thank you so much for calling. I think you might be quite surprised. Here at Yale University, where I live, where I taught for many years, the Center for British Art has a curator who's collected all kinds of things from the First World War. And some of the most amazing things are scrapbooks like the one you just described keeping during COVID. Imagine how it will be in the future for students and historians and future biographers to be able to see those fabric swatches. I know from looking back to World War I fabric swatches that for one thing, that the color doesn't fade because they go into books and then someone will come along and see them. And it becomes a whole way to bring history alive again for future generations. The same with your scrapbook that you kept when you were in college and earlier about the Vietnam War. I'm sure there's a historical society or something that will be interested in the fact that you took the time to do that. And I think you should give yourself a big pat on the back.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Deborah. And also what you were saying about the early scrapbookers, Jessica. The whole idea is not to worry about, I think, what somebody else is going to think about it later. This is the thing you're doing for yourself right now.
That's actually a really big piece of it. And I think in a moment when we look so much for consensus, when we are so awash in social media feeds that track our every move, and we're looking at how we and our beliefs align with the beliefs of others, the fact that someone like Deborah would take the time to do that becomes, I think, such a valuable vessel of information for maybe not for right this second, but I think it's fantastic. I wish more people would do it because those are the things that historians will need in the future. And they also allow us to take a pause and really just stop and think about what matters and what has value. And it's not about public consumption. It's about looking at a public moment in a very private way. And that is really the way we experience history, one person at one time doing one thing. And I think that is what gets lost in contemporary scrapbooking. It's what gets lost in contemporary media.
Well, mentioning social media makes me think I came into this conversation thinking, oh, you know, people on their Instagram or the blogs or whatever time period you're in, they're doing what the scrapbookers did. And I am exactly wrong, I think, because that's stuff you're doing with the intention of presenting it to other people as opposed to the scrapbook, which was not that thing.
That is the big difference, I think, Rob. I think you're right. That certainly you look at young people, and I've heard my students say, you know, I put something on Instagram, and if it doesn't get liked, I take it down. The idea that you would have a sentiment or something you wanted to express or share, and you would be so conscious of how it landed for others, as opposed to, you know, something that you feel quite strongly about. And it could be something private, like falling in love or having a baby. All those kinds of things are recorded in people's scrapbooks. But to the degree that what is going on right now in a world spinning out of control, certainly the fact that we're all at home with a lot more me time than any of us ever thought we'd have, and then on the heels of that, protests going on in every city in the country and in Europe and on other continents, it's a time to combine those activities and reflect on what you think is important. And what is important may be quite personal, but you'd be surprised that it might mean something to someone else at another time. And it doesn't have to be broadcast on social media to be meaningful. In fact, quite the opposite.
We're talking to Jessica Helfand, graphic designer, author of the book Scrapbooks in American History. We're talking about the past and present. And if you'd like the future of scrapbooking, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Ben is with us in Chippewa Falls. Ben, hi. Oop, Ben, do we have you there? Doesn't look like it. Okay, let's try a different caller while we see about Ben. How about Irene in Janesville? Irene, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about Irene?
Well, I have a scrapbook I started it in 2016, and it's about Trump and the things going on in this kind of presidency.
And are you putting like newspaper clippings and that sort of thing in there, Irene?
They're cartoons from my newspaper and other places. They're all cartoons.
Interesting. Irene, thank you so much. Jessica, I would imagine that there were probably, I don't know, people in the 19th century putting in editorial cartoons about, I don't know, Ulysses S. Grant and others.
Exactly. There's thematic scrapbooks as much as you can imagine. People collect what matters to them, but they become repositories of political history inadvertently, because you're not only seeing what was published on a daily basis in a newspaper or magazine, but what the personification was of politics at that time. What did the cartoonists think? What did the editorial writers think? They tend to be a little one-sided, because as someone who is pro a certain candidate will only save the things they want to go back and revisit. But be that as it may, they still become important documents for those of us who want to know what mattered.
Thanks a lot for that call, Irene, at 800-642-1234. What do you see, Jessica, as a trend these days in scrapbooking and what we might see in the future? Or I guess if people are doing this privately, we won't know what current trends are for another 50 years. I don't know.
We don't, but I think there are a number of artists who work in book form who are interested in how politics and how governance and how social unrest or even personal events can be documented. I wish there were more of those things shared broadly, because I think they show us that they're quite simple. I mean, a lined notebook gives you an opportunity to have a lot of writing. A non-lined notebook means you might want to, you know, be more bold with drawing or pasting things in. But I think that in terms of, at least when I was writing the book, and the book came out 12 years ago, it was published the day Obama was elected. So I'm a little rusty on what's going on in terms of the social gatherings of scrapbook makers. But it seemed to me that the market, which was a huge bustling market in art supplies, was very much subject to trends and, you know, patterns of things being exhibited by award-winning scrapbook makers, which means just like anything, you know, there will be certain colors in draperies or colors in scrapbooks. And I think that that has more to do with sort of the publication schedule and the media and the kinds of things that people like. It's not as much, at least it wasn't to me, as tied to the importance of world events or personal events. And I think when people just let themselves feel what they feel and write what they write and think what they think, that's when we get a much more, the veracity of that kind of material over time becomes an incredible testament to the structure of how we observe the world around us. And it's everything from, you know, your caller who just suggested that, I mean, Trump was only elected in 2016. Those cartoons have been coming fast and furious ever since. But there's all sorts of other ways we can save things and things we can choose to save and places to put them, libraries, put them online, share them with students, talk about them, you know, post them. You can actually make a scrapbook and post it on Instagram. But I think the more exciting thing is when you realize that you and your authorship are the sort of important inflection point between a large global event or a series of observations and what you're here to say. And then it's up to you about whether you want to keep that in your family for generations to come upon or sell it or put it on eBay. But I think increasingly there are libraries around the country that are collecting scrapbooks for just this reason. University of Delaware, when I was writing my book, was a big place that had scrapbooks. I found many of them on eBay, as I said. And I only wrote about American scrapbooks because you can't imagine just what an incredible arsenal of material there is in the United Kingdom. I mean, for people who really want to go deep, I mean, they can go back to the, you know, early 19th century, and the things at the Victoria and Albert Museum are just astonishing. If I had written about British scrapbooks, I would still be writing my book. I wouldn't have published it.
I got to ask, you've written about scrapbooks. You're an artist and a designer yourself. Have you kept scrapbooks or do you now?
I keep lots of different books. My most favorite book was that I have a daughter who just graduated from college, who's always been an inveterate drawer. And we traveled a lot when my children were young, and we kept a scrapbook we called 10 Things. And it was 10 Things I Know About X. So 10 Things I Know About Poughkeepsie, New York, or 10 Things I Know About India. Wherever we went, we wrote down 10 things. And it became a wonderful collaborative tool for pasting and drawing and saving and remarking on something with a child. And I look at that book now, she looks at it too, and you can track her evolution as an observer in the world. You can track how she became a better wordsmith, how her handwriting changed, the things that she observed, how much better she got and how much braver she got about expressing herself. And I think I've often thought that that would be a wonderful thing to publish for other families, because sometimes kids are, I think, natural scrapbookers, and I think sometimes they just need a little shove. They don't need our guidance, but they need a little support.
Jessica, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Jessica Helfand is an artist, designer, and writer. She's founding editor of Design Observer and the author of several books, including Scrapbooks and American History, and more recently, Face, A Visual Odyssey. She joined us today to talk about the practice of scrapbooking, past and present. You can keep sharing your stories, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at how the George Floyd demonstrations have been shaping up in some of Wisconsin's smaller communities. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a mining company has received approval to begin exploratory drilling this month near the Wolf River in Oneida County. We'll find out what that means and the prospects for mining in the area. First, protests continue across the U.S. and even beyond. This morning in New York City, protesters gathered outside the New York Police Department chanting Black Lives Matter and No Justice, No Peace. They also knelt for a short time in silent protest. In Houston, nearly 10,000 people are expected to attend a visitation for George Floyd. He grew up in that city and was buried next to his mother. He died while in Minneapolis police custody on Memorial Day. There were also weekend protests in the UK, Spain, Poland, Rome, and elsewhere. Here in Wisconsin, the demonstrations against police brutality and racial injustice have reached the state's smaller cities and towns. Many people who have never protested are getting involved, and rural areas are seeing unprecedented participation. Rob Mentzer has more.
On Saturday, some 1,500 people marched in Wausau in protest. The gathering there looked a lot like marches and protests across the country in the weeks since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer. But it was the largest political demonstration Wausau has seen in decades, maybe ever.
It's thrilling, but I mean, this has been everywhere.
Carmen Hohen is one of the organizers of the Wausau event. She says the movement has reached even smaller cities.
There have been protests, rallies in all 50 states, which is huge, and even across the world. Like, you see even, like, small towns that you wouldn't think would have protests, but, like, Annaghill, Rhinelander, everyone's coming together.
All right, you guys, how are you doing today?
About 40,000 people live in Wausau. Its march on Saturday was among the largest the state has seen outside of Madison and Milwaukee. It's a sign of how broad and far-reaching the protest movement has become. For people of color like Hohen and another organizer, Gwen Taylor, the event was also a way to assert their right to belong.
Being part of a minority community, you don't always feel the numbers in small communities. I think it's even more important, if not just as important, for the small communities to come out together, for people to feel welcomed and come out of the woodwork and see that our community is diverse and we have strength in that diversity.
In the last week alone, there have been protests across Wisconsin's rural landscape. Hundreds marched in Sturgeon Bay and in Shawano. On Saturday, about 60 people gathered in Hayward, population 2,300. On Wednesday, northern Wisconsin protesters walked across the bridge from Marinette to Menominee, Michigan. For lots of participants, it's their first time at a protest. Caitlin Schultz joined her first protest in Wausau at the end of May. She's been to three more in central Wisconsin since then. She has time to protest because she lost her job amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But she's also been moved by the experience.
I'm kind of an emotional person, so I tend to tear up and I might cry a little bit, and I get goosebumps when people are honking and stuff. And I just, you feel good. You feel like you're doing something important.
Make some noise!
In Superior on Thursday, 21-year-old Clivia Prince said she does worry about her safety and the safety of her younger brother as Black people in a mostly white city. But she says seeing community support for the protests has helped her.
Seeing a lot of not people of color supporting us and seeing that they do care about our lives and they do care that we're people too.
For the most part, small cities have not seen the vandalism or violent clashes between police and protesters that have marked some large city protests. Ephraim Nikwai is a member of Superior's Police and Fire Commission. He says he hopes small cities can be a model for how to bring people together.
And when you look at the protest today, we see how peaceful it is. We see how engaged people were. You see all the honking of cars, and just to show that the community really supports it. And this is an example that we could share with other communities.
You guys, let's have a great, peaceful protest.
In Wausau, organizers worked with police to put on Saturday's event. They say the march is the beginning of a movement that's still growing. Wausau organizer Kaylee McCauley says she's as surprised as anyone at how widespread the protest movement has become in just weeks.
I feel a joy and a hope that if you would have asked me a week and a half ago, I could not truly say that I felt.
In a speech, McCauley told attendees that she was shocked in the best of ways to see more than 1,000 people marching with her. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Rob Mentzer joins us now with more on the story he's been covering. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Well, protests we think of as a big city thing. That tends to get a lot of the TV coverage. Talk about what we're seeing a little more, as you explained there in that feature, in these George Floyd-related protests around the state.
Oh, absolutely. So just to take Wausau as an example, so there was a protest march in 2016 in Wausau after a 15-year-old Hmong boy was charged with a homicide. There was a local event that coincided with the women's march around Donald Trump's inauguration. Before that, there were Tea Party protests like in 2010, 2011, and Iraq War protests before that. And all of those were they range somewhere between, you know, dozens or hundreds of participants. There were, you know, well more than 1,000 people marching on Saturday. Estimates seem to be closer to 1,500. And so that, I mean, it just dwarfs what the city has really seen.
And as we just heard there, this is a story we're hearing in communities even smaller than Wausau around the state, maybe not getting those four-digit numbers, but recently at least unprecedented numbers of people turning out for protests.
Absolutely right. Yeah. The mayor of Merrill, Wisconsin, population of less than 10,000 people, posted a photo last week of people with signs protesting outside the courthouse there. I was hearing from people in New Richmond or in Hayward this weekend. So yes, even though, you know, certainly some of these local protests are on a smaller scale, the fact that it's so widespread and so broad is new. It really is something that we have not seen in many of these communities.
People might think of these communities we're talking about as predominantly white communities. How would you describe the ethnic and racial makeup of the protests that you covered?
Well, very multi-ethnic. And I think that this is like really a significant part of what is going on here. And I talked to more, you know, this is in the story, but more than one of the sources I talked to reflected on the way that these protests give visibility for people of color in a community that is in, you know, you think of as predominantly white and is predominantly white. Like, so WASA is less than 2% African American. So as a, like on paper, you think to yourself, well, that's not very many. But in a city of 40,000 people, if it's 1.2% African American, it means that there are 500 black people in WASA. And that, you know, account for Asian Americans or Latinx people, other minority groups. And, it starts to be actual significant numbers. And that was something that was really evident in the WASA event and in others across the state.
I want to give a listen to one of the organizers of the WASA march that you talked to, Kaylee McCauley.
And although I am saddened by the reason that we have all been moved to congregate here this morning, I think I speak for all of the organizers when I say we feel uplifted, we feel empowered, and we are shocked in the best of ways to see the number of people here with us today.
Yeah, so Kaylee's 20 years old, and I spoke with her after the event, and this is really it has been a significant moment for her in that she described sort of really feeling a despair around the death of George Floyd and the apparent lack of progress around racial justice issues, and she has seen seeing the support on Saturday. She said made her feel encouraged in a way that she wouldn't have even like thought possible before. And it's, you know, it's really a significant moment for her.
And Rob, what have you seen when it comes to interactions between police and protesters?
There were police in WASA, and there have been police present at a number of small city protests in Shawano or Marinette or elsewhere. They've tended to really stay by the sidelines. In WASA, the police, you know, the protesters worked with the police to organize this event and close down a route for the march in downtown WASA. Police handed out water to protests. It was kind of hot that day. And so in general, you know, I think the small cities, they have really been, they've tended to happen during daytime hours. There hasn't been the sort of vandalism, and police in general have been pretty hands off.
Now, this is, of course, all going on during COVID-19. People have been wondering about precautions protesters have taken. Did you see anything along those lines?
Well, a lot of masks, not a lot of distancing. For better or worse, these protests are coming at a time when Wisconsin has lifted its formal restrictions, and a lot of people are making the choice to lift their sort of strictest social distancing measures. Whether they should or shouldn't be doing that is a question to ask. But as those sort of like social distancing practices had already begun to fray here in these protests, they're outdoors and people do have the ability to wear masks. A majority do. This is something that it's clear that a lot of people are willing to do, even as they may not be fully returning to normal life in other ways.
As we wrap up, Rob, from what you heard from organizers, are these one-off protests or are some of them planning to do more in the weeks to come?
I think that all of them are planning to do more. WASA in particular has had three different events so far. A lot of energy went into this last weekend, and that's true in a lot of communities. This weekend was sort of a focus for a lot of the organizers, and they are taking a breath at this moment. But I don't think anyone who organized a protest thinks that they're going to stop here, and I would expect to see more participation as the summer continues.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau. We talked to him today about protests against racial inequality taking place in Wisconsin's small and mid-sized communities. Coming up, a company is set to begin some exploratory drilling for mineral content near the Wolf River in Oneida County this month. We'll get the details coming up on Central Time.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jake Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at @centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas, and thanks.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new PBS documentary looks at the history of socialist leadership in Milwaukee. We'll talk to one of the producers about the legacy left by the city's three socialist mayors. First, according to filed documents, a company called Badger Minerals is approved to begin what is called exploratory drilling in Oneida County. Some of the holes, which would likely average a depth of 400 feet, would be within a few thousand feet of the Wolf River. This would be the first mining-related exploratory drilling in Oneida County since at least the 1980s. Ben Meyer is the special topics correspondent at WXPR, based in Rhinelander. He covers water and water resources in northern Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet, Rob. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about what this exploratory drilling would look like.
Yeah, you bet. Well, actually, the conversation we're having is coming at a good time. The drilling actually began last week on a plot in eastern Oneida County. As you mentioned, Rob, some of the sites are within about a half mile of the Wolf River, and exploratory drilling is the very earliest stages of mining exploration, of potential mining exploration. It's, as you mentioned, the company is looking and has started to drill holes, in some cases as many as 400 feet deep, to get what are called cores, which they'll then do testing on to determine the mineral content below the surface. Expected that this is in a kind of a volcanic sulfide band that goes across northern Wisconsin, and this band in certain areas includes minerals like lead and copper, silver and gold in some cases. So the company wants to find out what's under the ground and on this plot in what's called the Oneida County town of Shepke, in anticipation that maybe someday it might be profitable to open a mine on the site.
So it sounds like it would be a long time between what just started happening, this exploratory drilling, and a hypothetical future mine?
Yeah, so the mining process from idea to completion is always a very long process, not only because it requires so much machinery and infrastructure, but because there are several regulatory steps along the way as well. You know, in talking with the company, this is a company called Badger Minerals. They're Michigan-based. They're a subsidiary of a Canadian company. A representative told me that probably at the earliest, their estimate is, if everything were to go just right, a potential mine in this area would be at least 10 years off. So we're looking at a stretch of time, but that certainly, that stretch of time doesn't mean some people that are against mining aren't getting a little nervous in this area.
Right. I was going to say mining and Wisconsin, there's likely to be some kind of controversy. Were people objecting even to the permitting process for these exploratory drilling measures?
Oh, no doubt. We've seen a couple of physical protests that have been organized in some cases by landowners in the area. This is a pretty remote area of Oneida County, not much population there, but the people that do own land there, there are concerns there. There are a couple of tribal nations that are right nearby as well, including the Secaucus Chippewa tribe in Mole Lake, which is, you know, less than 5 miles away from some of the proposed drilling sites. Forest County Potawatomi is in the area. The Menominee Tribal Nation is downriver on the Wolf River from this area. So there's certainly plenty of concern there. And in the permitting process on Oneida County's side for this exploratory drilling, we heard a lot of backlash. And as I mentioned, we've seen some of these in-person protests, a couple of them already as well. Similar to if your listeners remember some of the uncertainty surrounding Gilgibbick Taconite and Ashland and Iron counties, a couple of years ago, there's that same kind of uneasiness about the entire mining process, no matter what step it is here in Oneida County.
We're talking to Ben Meyer from WXPR in Rhinelander, talking about exploratory drilling in Oneida County. Ben, as you have reported, our laws when it comes to metallic mining are in flux. The laws changed, and now we're figuring out how to implement those. What's going on at the state and local levels?
Right. So you might remember within the last couple of years, under a Republican Senate, a Republican Assembly, and a Republican governor at the time, Scott Walker, the process for getting a permit for a metallic mine, and this is what's called a sulfide mine, these types of minerals are called sulfide minerals, that process has really been streamlined. So there are fewer regulatory hurdles along the way. Now, this is the first time that the state and state regulators have kind of started going through this process since that new regulatory process has been put into place. And truth be told, they're promulgating the rules and kind of figuring out exactly how to regulate on the fly in some senses as they work through this process in Oneida County. The last exploratory drilling, as you mentioned, that happened in Oneida County was back in the 1980s. The last exploratory drilling of any kind in the state of Wisconsin is 8 years old. It happened at the Bend deposit in Taylor County. Hasn't resulted in a mine there yet, certainly. But there's a very new process that the state is working through, this kind of expedited permitting process that's kind of being tested for the first time.
You've written about water quality and mine waste and other areas. What are some of the things that have happened in mines that have people worried about, digging near the Wolf River?
Yeah, certainly. So I mentioned this concept of sulfide minerals. So digging a mine in an area where there are sulfide minerals, again, lead and copper and silver and gold, is a lot different than digging in other places or in other ways. If you dig a stone quarry, a limestone quarry, that's a heck of a lot different than digging a sulfide mine. Because with a sulfide mine, if it's an open pit mine at very least, you're exposing these minerals to the air and exposing these minerals to the water. These sulfide minerals have ties to water contamination. They have ties to acid rain. And that's made a lot of people, as you can imagine, uneasy. You know, the last mine similar to this in Wisconsin was the Flambeau mine in Ladysmith in Rusk County. That's since been, it's called remediated. You wouldn't know if there was a mine there if you went out there today. But that was near the Flambeau River. Still, though, after that closed in 1997, there are still people that are concerned about the water quality in that area because of concerns about sulfide mining.
And you got statements from the company itself. How did they address local concerns about a potential mine?
Well, they said, perhaps what you might expect to hear them say, Rob, is first of all, we're a long way away. And this is true. This exploratory drilling is just the very first step in a potential mining process. It might well be that the mining company does exploratory drilling and says it's not worth the trouble. There's nothing profitable here for us to even go forward. They have, for their part, have said that they're interested in upholding the strictest environmental standards to keep Wisconsin air and water and our natural resources clean. But at the same time, they're quick to point out that a potential mine would be an economic boon, they say, for this part of Oneida County and this part of the northern part of Wisconsin, which is very rural, which tends to have higher unemployment than the rest of the state. So they're pointing to what they say is their concern for environmental issues, but also pointing to economic issues too, and saying this could be a boon for this area. And that's, you know, some of the terminology that mining advocates have used over the years as well in terms of streamlining the mining process and streamlining the mine permitting process in Wisconsin.
And just in our last 20 seconds or so, Ben, what is the next step you're watching for?
Next step I'm watching for is if we get any information about what they find. If they find that the minerals underneath the ground are profitable, that would seem to give them some motivation to go forward with the next step in thinking about mining here in eastern Oneida County.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet, Rob. Thanks for the time.
We've been talking to Ben Meyer, special topics correspondent at WXPR based in Rhinelander. He joins us today to talk about some exploratory mining that is in the works near the Wolf River in Oneida County. That exploratory mining actually going on as of last week, looking at potential mining in the area. As we heard, if they find something useful in there, it would be still probably a decade off before mining would actually happen. Here's a story from my brother. He and his family live in San Francisco, and over the weekend they started hearing a spooky noise all over town. It sounded like this recording. Okay, well, there's the sound. Turns out they weren't the only ones hearing it. What was going on? As reported by KQED Public Radio, the world-famous Golden Gate Bridge recently got an upgrade. The goal was to help build wind resistance for the bridge. I don't fully understand all the engineering involved here, but it involved installing a series of slats alongside the sidewalks on the bridge. As someone who plays wind instruments, I know that when you force a lot of air through tight spaces, it can create vibrations, and that can make sound. Turns out that's exactly what's happening now on the Golden Gate Bridge when the wind hits it just right. And it's not a mistake. Some of the initial reporting says it was an accident, a mistake that was made along the way. Actually, the bridge managers say the change was needed to keep up the structural integrity of Golden Gate, and the sound was just a necessary trade-off. So as KQED reports, the sound can be heard miles away, and it sounds like, quote, the city is one big David Lynch movie. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.